Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today we're joined by Evan Mills, Dr. Evan Mills, who spent the majority of his career at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. I've known Evan for years and have long admired his research and his communication skills. He's pseudo-retired, but he's still an affiliate at the lab and a research affiliate at the Energy and Resources Group at the University of California. Just delighted to have Evan on the show today. Hey, Evan, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's so great to be here and talk with you again.
I know. I can't believe how long it's been since we have spoken. Like 5, 6, 7, 8 years, maybe?
Yeah.
A long time. Anyway, looking good. Tell me, what are you working on these days professionally? What's going on?
Well, I'm following my bliss with kind of self-directed research and projects, if you will. I still maintain an affiliation with Lawrence Berkeley Lab and have those interactions available, which are great. But there's so many things that, you know, there aren't necessarily sponsors or funding for, or aren't mainstream hot topics that get lots of resources, but I think are important. So I spend time on them. And I think, communications is very important. Communications to general audiences is very important. So I spend a lot of time writing, you know, 1,000-word op-eds and commentaries and things like that on topics in our space of energy and sustainability and environment. And I enjoy doing that and having the luxury to do that. Broadly, that's what I'm doing or how I'm approaching my professional presence.
Yeah, it sounds very fulfilling. Like you said, the freedom to delve into areas of interest to you where you want to make a statement.
It is, and things that have been knocking around in the head for a long time, but there's never been opportunity to flesh them out and chase them, and that is really rewarding. And then I have plenty of non-energy interests, so to speak, and other things that I do in life. I'm a very avid closed-loop organic gardener, and my mom was a very important, interesting artist, and I've spent a lot of time on her kind of retrospective and documenting her work and working on another book project not related to energy. And getting a bit also into forest management and carbon and forests, and being a bit of a gadfly to Cal Fire, which is really screwing up royally in California and how they're managing their so-called demonstration forests, demonstrating worst practices or poor practices, I should say. So I do venture out more often than not into other topics.
You sound incredibly busy. It kind of like my grandfather when he retired. He said he couldn't imagine how he ever kept a full-time job.
Yeah, it's the work fills the space that's available.
Well, now you've kind of gotten known for what this pinpointing sleeper uses of energy, right? Is that sort of a theme that you've sort of grabbed onto? And you've said, okay, here's areas that people really need to know about.
Yeah, in reflecting back, you know, it's in looking back and thinking about, you know, is there a method to the madness? Is there a pattern? Is there, you know, what kinds of things have I ended up doing and being attracted to? And yeah, the edge cases, you know, there are so many topics that don't get attention, as I alluded to before, from don't get attention from mainstream policies or programs or research agendas. And, you know, there've been so many of them. I've worked on, like the problem of kerosene lighting in the developing world, you know, more generally energy access, people like to call it, but helped to bring in white LEDs with small rechargeable batteries and tiny solar panels that are all shrink wrapped and ready to go, don't require electricians, very actually affordable, you know. A lot on this issue of insurance and how is the insurance industry affected by climate change? What are the risks and opportunities? Green gaming, that's a great example. My son and I kind of stumbled into this question of computer gaming, video gaming, and started pulling on that thread some years ago on our own time, and found just an extraordinary, you know, $5 billion a year energy bill in the United States from freaking video gaming and what's going on, and, you know, are there efficiency opportunities? And that ended up becoming a big California Energy Commission project at LBL, and we built a whole gaming lab and tested left and right and up and down all these different platforms, virtual reality. The games themselves, you know, have an effect. One game will use more energy than another game, and just fascinating, you know, array of results and interests, interesting facets that come out and policy recommendations and so on. In the early 80s, I was working on low-income housing and low-income, housing energy issues. Before that was a lot of a big topic. Worked with on public housing originally. Actually, my master's thesis was energy use in public housing in 1987. And we had work at LBL, you know, after that and before, during, and after that on the topic. So I think these edges and the one that's most compelling and interesting right now is the carbon footprint of indoor cannabis cultivation, which is a classic topic that nobody works on. And policymakers don't want to touch it. And the environmental groups don't want to touch it. But it's very fascinating and very prodigious. Also similar to gaming, actually, $5, $6 billion a year of energy use in the United States for energy intensive. So indoor agriculture more broadly. So I don't know, for me, those are the kind of edge case things that are, it's not the light bulbs and the refrigerators and the water heaters, although those are important too.
How interesting. You thrive on diversity, I can tell. Let's back up just for a minute. I want to talk about the cannabis industry and the green gaming some more and the insurance connection with the IPCC. But let's just back up for the sake of the audience. Everybody, feedback I get from these podcasts, by the way, Evan, is that people like hearing about so where you're coming from and not just your professional accomplishments, but born and raised where?
Yeah, roots are important. Well, half a step before that, my grandparents hitchhiked out to California from New York in the 1920s to Los Angeles. Looking back at old yellow pictures, they were out very outdoorsy. You know, they were at these camps in the Catskills and other areas and camping, and they were vegetarians in the 30s. And there was even a fruitarian in the family, Ted.
Wow.
And into physical fitness and things like that. And so really interesting family. And I was born and raised in, so they hitchhiked out to LA and worked and lived in Hollywood. And I was born and raised in the fabled Laurel Canyon in the Hollywood Hills and grew up there. And I was too young to get into much trouble, unfortunately, but, you know, literally Joni Mitchell lived, you know, a few doors down the street, and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young were there, and Zappa was there, and Carol King was there, and her kids were in my class, you know, in grammar school growing up. The Renaissance Pleasure Fair was born there. Your California listeners will know about it, you know, a block away. My best friend's parents, you know, created it. He's now running that company. So born and raised in Los Angeles, Hollywood Hills.
What interesting. I love that history of the Laurel Canyon and all the musicians. I read voraciously about that era and
I was there before it was glitzy, and you know, it was just hyper creative, and you know, the upbringing was rich. I mean, there were artists, there were scientists, there were intellectuals, you know, what today we like to call creatives of all sorts around, and I had incredible mentors. And my parents were among them. You know, my parents were very interesting people, both of them.
Was the move to Berkeley and your academic career then, was that rooted in your grandparents' sort of environmentalism and all, do you think?
Well, that's the reason I mentioned it. I mean, really, there was so much time outdoors and in nature and kind of an ethic and values around that. So it certainly wasn't a coincidence that I got into this field. And my dad, you know, in the 70s, you know, when I was a teenager and heading towards college, he's like, look into solar energy, Evan, and look into energy savings. And these are also people who grew up in times of prudence and, you know, the World War, and, you know, turn off the lights when you leave the room. And even at that very fundamental level, the values were around in ways that they aren't in the same way today.
So was the first stop Berkeley then in the college career?
No, I went to a fabulous alternative high school in Southern California, and then I went to Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, and I got exposed to energy and buildings energy there, transferred and got hooked right away, and then transferred, I don't know, as a sophomore, I think, to UC Berkeley, and finished my bachelor's and my master's there in the Energy and Resources Group.
And then here comes the Swedish connection. And it was with Thomas Johansson, was the professor there at Lund University. That
it was over there. Very, very important person. I did at Berkeley run into this character named Art Rosenfeld, who was was so influential and worked with him at LBL, even as an undergrad, and Art knew Tomas. Yeah. And when I was kind of ready, I think it was between, it was after my master's, and I was, you know, looking to do something out of the box, different cultural context, different academic context for a little while, and then come back to California. And he said, well, Tomas is looking for someone to be a guest researcher in his department at Lund University. And Tomas, he's the kind of one of the grandfathers of global sustainable energy scenario thinking. And he worked a lot with Bob Williams at Princeton very closely, and Amulya Reddy from India, and Jose Goldenberg from Brazil, all of whom were big figures, you know, in global energy and development issues. And so I ended up spending 4 years in Sweden doing my PhD under Tomas. And we worked on the main kind of organizing topic was the nuclear phase out in Sweden, which came immediately on the heels of Chernobyl. And, you know, I went there in 87, and Chernobyl was 86. And Sweden, as you might remember, they were the first country to measure it and tell the world right across the Baltic there. And so Sweden had a referendum on nuclear power, a very rare political public decision to phase out all nuclear. And then they also had the equivalent of referenda on not building out their wild rivers in the north. So more hydro was not an option. And then they also, even back then, wanted to cap and reduce CO2. So how do you do that? You know, how do you not use your rivers, and how do you not use nuclear? So my main project there was building scenarios of Sweden without nuclear, without more hydro, and with vastly less carbon, and ideally without increasing the cost of energy services. So that was, you know, a big baptism into scenario work and global thinking and futures studies. And that forecasting is one thing, but we have self-determination, so we can also do scenarios and find good scenarios for the future and figure out the path and how to get to them, and not just let the future, energy future in this case, just happen to us.
And well, and I imagine that the energy efficiency was at the root of the
core.
The core of the solution.
Absolutely, yeah. And we looked at all sectors. So that also got me out of the building sector. We looked at transportation and industry and non-residential. So it was a whole electric industry scenario. Yeah. Efficiency first. It was true then, and it's true now. But then we brought in renewables behind it to make up to provide the demand that was necessary.
And then after Sweden, back to LBNL.
Sure.
And let's talk about Art for a second. I was lucky enough to have gotten to know Art pretty well because I was working for Amory Lovins at the time. And Art was out all the time and back and forth. And most of the people.
Fingers in crime. Yeah.
Most of the people you mentioned, I got to meet through Amory, who's still in my life. I still own my house right next to the old original RMI headquarters out in Colorado. But talk about Art. What an inspiration.
Yeah. You know, my most important mentor. And the bar was high. I mean, I had a lot of, through life, really great people, but Art was the most important. Infectious enthusiasm, right? And drive and intellectual curiosity. Yeah. And I just blundered into a class of his at Berkeley. I didn't know who he was. Blundered into a class with him. Marianne Piette was a student there. Alan Meyer wasn't in the class, but Carl Bloomstein was in there auditing, and other interesting people, and then Art brought in other people from the community to do, you know, sub lecturing. But at any rate, he just said one day, "Hey, you want to come up the hill?" I don't know, what's the hill? Oh, Lawrence Berkeley Lab. What's that? And oh, just get in my VW Rabbit, you know, and we'll be up there in 5 minutes, and I'll show you around. And 40 years later, I was retiring. You know, he was so inclusive. And so I started in 82 as a student, and then it was immediately folded in, to the community up there. I eventually became his deputy in the Center for Building Science, and then the director for the Center for Building Science when he went to work in the first Clinton administration. And, you know, we continued to collaborate over the years and write stuff together and interact and, you know each other's families. Very rare combination of benevolence and brilliance, you know, like I said, just so generous. You know, those days, your older listeners will know what a Rolodex is, you know, and he would open his Rolodex and he'd pull out a card and he'd throw it on the copy machine. It's like, oh, you have to call this person, you have to call that person. The opposite of territorial, you know, just so sharing and sharing of credit and even, funding. I mean, he won the Fermi Award, $400,000, I think, from the Department of Energy later in his career. And he gave all that money away to, different people. I was included in the list to help them with their Skunk Works project. That actually was helping to fund my original kerosene off-grid LED lighting displacement of kerosene work. And I learned a lot from him about communication and getting the word out and taking the time, to talk to non-specialists and boil down, your message. And I think topically, our main, if there was kind of an umbrella, what is the return on investment in R&D? Because of course we were in an R&D ecosystem, and he was constantly the spearhead of defending budgets against the Reagans of the world and making the case that this public investment in energy R&D, pays for itself many times over. And so we did a lot of, analysis and writing together on that. And we got kind of at my suggestion, actually, later we got into this area of non-energy benefits, which now we more call co-benefits. And he and I wrote, arguably the first paper on that, way back in the 90s. What is it besides saving BTUs? Well, is there a safety benefit? Is there a quality benefit? What are the other co-benefits that come along with energy efficiency? So we got to collaborate on really interesting topics.
What a terrific tribute you just gave to Art Rosenfeld. And I had Andrew McAllister on the show just a couple weeks ago, and Art of course went on to the California Energy Commission, and he said that that was his favorite job. Of course, I think probably when he was at Berkeley, he said that was his favorite job too. But Andrew and I re just reflected on the fact that that unit of energy, the Rosenfeld, what is that, the annual output of a typical 500 megawatt power plant? What a
I'm
great.
one of 100 co-authors on that paper,
Are
Ted.
you?
Yes.
Oh, that now that's the perfect
It
segue.
was a tribute paper, to Art, and let's memorialize him with a new unit, so he can be remembered alongside the BTU.
That's incredible. That is fantastic. Well, now you're also involved with the IPCC, and you're one of the hundreds of scientists that jointly received the Nobel Prize in what was that, 2007?
Sounds about right.
And your role was, you said to me in an email recently that your role was, I think, involving or looking at the insurance industry or bringing in the insurance. Can you kind of clarify that role and
Sure, happy to chat about it. So first of all, I mean, most people in our community know the third of the three working groups in IPCC. So there are three giant working groups. One looks at climate chemistry, what's happening, the physics and the climate. The other looks at vulnerability, impacts, and adaptation. And the third one looks at what they call mitigation, meaning emissions reduction. And most of our friends, of course, are in the third bucket spiritually. I got to work in the second one because we started looking, the issue was what is the vulnerability of different sectors of the economy, tourism, agriculture, et cetera. What about insurance? Which is, most people don't know this, but it is the world's largest industry. Insurance is three times the revenue today of the oil industry, oil and gas industry combined, $6 trillion a year. And so I got, and that actually grew out of the non-energy benefits work, because in that work with Art, because we were looking at, well, do you have less risk of mold formation in a home, or do you have better resilience when the power is out? Or, is a spray foam roof more wind resilient in hurricane territory because it's fastened better to the top plates of the walls, and so that we didn't think about insurance at that time, but like safety, durability, risk more generically. And so I was primed to, I just kind of, one of these lights goes on, and various readings and encounters with people that, hey, what about the insurance industry as a stakeholder here? So at any rate, the IPCC had a whole chapter in Working Group 2 on, they called it financial services because we looked at banking and insurance. And I was the co-lead author. And there were about 15 sub-authors under us, but I was one of the really heavy lifting people at the chapter level. And I also had other IPCC work later. I think I was part of six or seven chapters, over several assessment cycles. So I also did work in mitigation efficiency chapters later. I worked on a North America impacts chapter. where we looked at kind of my contribution was what about the North American insurance industry, and did some work on wildfire in there also, but a different part of IPCC than a lot of folks have worked on. And that also led to the, we have these US national climate assessments here that are like mini IPCCs for North America or for the US, and they're done also on a multi-annual basis. And I got to be a lead author in that subsequently, and that was really fascinating.
Well, congratulations. I'm proud of you. I hope your family's proud of you. But
it was a great thing to be part of. I mean, crucible for learning, you know, being, you know, traveling around the world to all these meetings, all these unbelievable people, you know, who are looking at every aspect of the climate problem, way beyond energy use and way beyond energy end use, and smart people and great writing, great, very well organized, you know, so it was a wonderful learning opportunity. Things weren't always fun, you know, wading into this area, because I got into this brought me directly into the question of what the academics jargonistically call attribution, I'm sorry, of, well, okay, this is happening. We have this flood, we have this fire, we have this windstorm, but we can't attribute that to climate change. And so there was just then beginning to emerge a technical field and analytical, you know, machinery, brain trust to look at attribution and use advanced statistics. And I'm not a statistician, but I got drawn into that because so many of the data came from the insurance industry. Mm-hmm. Of rising losses, loss events, loss costs, because they're the counters, you know, yeah. They're in the hub. So many of these losses channel through the insurance industry, the costs accumulate there, and then in the impacts, and then they're distributed back out in the form of premiums and payouts. And so, you know, I was attacked by Patrick Michaels, you know, coal industry shill on climate denialism, you know, in popular media, ad hominem attacks by other people who will go unnamed, big debate in Science magazine. I had an article in Science about insurance in 2005 around this issue, and this scathing, you know, letter came in, and then I was given a whole page to respond to the letter, and it was a crucible, you know, it was very intense, and, you know, when your work is attacked in such a kind of mean-spirited way, but under a pseudo-scientific, you know, veil. And the other one that I'll always remember, I was going to Australia. I was invited by the Australian Insurance Associations to come and keynote one of their big annual meetings. And I'm like getting ready to go to Australia, and I'm reading up about Australia and climate change. And I pull up YouTube, and there's a news story, and this climate scientist is giving a speech in Australia on climate change solutions and so on. And this person from in the back of the room comes running towards the podium with a gallows noose in his hand. You know, it has to be bodily removed from the, I mean, it's funny, right? But it's more than funny. It's threatening, it's dangerous, it's scary. And I'm like about to get on the plane to go down there. Not that we didn't have those kind of people here too, but it was not always, it was fun and it was intriguing, but it wasn't always pleasant.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about the cannabis industry. America's number one cash crop, I understand from something that you wrote. But your focus has been on the ESG lens. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So it started with energy, and these indoor cultivation facilities, which are about 60% now of all cannabis production in the United States, are indoor factory farms that are, they have to be run. It's like you have to recreate Hawaii in Fargo, North Dakota. You have to recreate Hawaii in Phoenix, Arizona, meaning you need a nice, gentle 80 degrees, 50% humidity when it's 120 outside or when it's minus 20 outside. And so these facilities are incredibly energy intensive, and that had not been documented, had not been analyzed, had not been modeled. And so I got involved in that about 2011, 2010, wrote a paper in energy policy, did the first kind of broad brush analysis of it, and, you know, found that these facilities were, you know, 70 times more energy intensive than the warehouses that were being repurposed, you know, for them. And, you know, all these different energy metrics, and it was 3 million cars worth of CO2 emissions nationally, kind of bottom line. And these are Walmart-sized buildings, as energy intensive as data centers. And so that was kind of the starting point. And, you know, what do you do? But more recently, so ESG, you know, as most listeners probably know, is stands for environment, social, and governance. And this is a often poorly understood, actually, in popular realm. It's not about, are you doing good in the world? ESG is an analysis framework that's applied to companies, typically traded companies, and entities like Morningstar, Standard & Poor have ESG rating lenses, but they're concerned about business risk. They're concerned about environment, social, and governance activities that could affect solvency, could affect litigation, could cause litigation, things that hurt the business and hurt the shareholders. And so the E was clear enough on cannabis. I was invited to write an article in a journal that specializes on this. Huge dollar spend. So it's an issue for financial solvency for the companies because they're spending 40% of their costs are for energy. You know, commercial building, as we famously said all these years, 1% of the cost is energy. Most of it's employees, it's other things. But this is a very energy sensitive industry. And but then on the social side, you know, there's environmental justice, kind of come back to that in a second, if you'd like. There's a huge disproportionate impact of the energy use of the industry on lower income, non-white, already environmentally overburdened populations. We can circle back if you want. And then the governance side, it more speaks to kind of transparency on carbon and energy, stranded asset risk, and the behavior of corporate leaders. And, you know, as you probably know, you know, Musk got thrown off of the Standard & Poor ESG index. How would you throw Tesla off of the ESG list? Because they're not transparent. You know, they're not being clear on how they get their cobalt or their other critical minerals, and they're doing it in ways that are not socially responsible, and let alone the things outside of environment like racism. And so Tesla, like, you're out of here, you know. So ESG is about the behavior of these companies through all these lenses, and my work on the energy fed into that. We can chat about environmental justice for a second if you want. It's very poignant.
I want to ask a follow-up question on the energy side of it, because what's the solution? Is the solution that we ought to be growing outdoors in climates that are conducive, that you're not trying to recreate, like you said, Hawaii in the middle of the winter in North Dakota? Is that fundamentally the solution? And if that's the case, why isn't that being done? Why are we having houses?
Yeah. No, it is the right question. And the answer is yes. You know, originally I came into it like any good disciple of Art Rosenfeld. It's like, we can throw efficient light bulbs at this problem and fix it. And after a dozen years hammering at this from every angle, it's like, no, we can't. It's just too energy intensive, too problematic. And so, just for example, okay, we want to zero out the carbon footprint with solar panels on the roof. Let's throw solar at it. 20 times the roof area.
Yeah, sure.
You can't do that. I mean, we could talk about centralized grid renewables. It's just a bad idea. We're not building that fast enough. We need that for critical activities like hospitals and houses where you have to be inside and you need electricity services. To squander that on cannabis is, it's irresponsible, you know, to the point of kind of being unethical. So yes, it's been done outside for 5,000 years until about 30 years ago, you know, and
why did that happen 30 years ago? I think in Colorado, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think all of the cannabis has to be grown within the state, I thought.
Well, every state, because there's federal interstate transit port prohibitions, because it's Schedule I federally. So no state can import. There might be some chinks starting to happen. I'm not quite sure. But basically, we have the federal position has created so much trouble, not just on energy, but on medical research, on financing, on insurance, all kinds of things. But you know, you have to grow everything in state. So if you're in North Dakota or if you're in Arizona, I mean, Arizona is not a good climate. I mean, you could do some, but the reality is, I did the math. We only need like 0.003% So 0.003% of all American agricultural land to grow the 17,000 tons of cannabis that people are consuming these days. It's like we need a very small amount of land to do it. And you could do that in Hawaii. You could do it all in Hawaii.
Oh, cool area. So it's federal regulation that is.
Well, that's not the only. No, yeah. So you asked the question. I mean, there are so many reasons. Originally, it was to be covert in part. It was just to get out of so that helicopters flying over didn't know what you were doing until they had the infrared cameras. And they could. But no, there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of arguments that all are quite debunkable. But there's a whole list of things. Obviously, you're controlling nature. You know, I mean, this is good. You don't have to worry about hailstorms. You don't have to worry about certain pests. You have to worry about others like mold. You have a much more uniform labor market because it growing indoors, you have up to seven crops a year. Seven crops a year indoors. Outdoors in Hawaii, you can get three. So it's not like one versus seven. Again, it goes to geography and choices. So there are a lot of reasons, but the industry is buckling under the costs and the unexpected costs, the capital costs. I mean, these facilities, they'll spend $100 million building a cannabis grow. Big one, you know, but there are multi-million square foot facilities.
Yeah.
One of them in downtown Oakland, in a impoverished neighborhood, these investors from Colorado came in, borrowed $50 million from the bank, bought two historic warehouses, set up 5 acres of canopy indoors, blew the PG&E grid out, brought in a dozen 50-foot diesel tractor trailer generators, and ran them for 2 years to run these grows before getting shut down by the ham-handed regulators who were completely aware of it the whole time and just couldn't pull the trigger. And this is the most non-white part of Oakland, the poorest part of Oakland, and the already most environmentally overburdened. And you have, you know, in addition to diesel fumes and things like that, you have volatile organic compounds coming off of the plants that are okay in very small consumer quantities and are unhealthful. You know, workers are exposed to 1,000 times the background level of VOCs who are inside.
Evan, let me jump in here. We're running a little bit over time, and I want to get to a little bit of your house project in the last bit here. But is there a solution for this cannabis highly intensive energy use? Is there a solution?
Yeah, no problem. Outdoors, sustainably, you can have very unsustainable agriculture, but we've shown you can grow it actually with less land area and less water use, which is debunks a myth about indoors being an advantage. But we need, you know, policy, just like with everything. Yeah. And we need interstate transport. Although, you know, most states can do something outdoors seasonally, but they just, you know, if you have to.
But
it's not a problem technically or botanically. It's a problem public policy wise.
Very interesting. Okay, very good. We could talk about that all day and all night, I think, which is so fascinating. Let's talk about you. I think it was in 2008, you decided to take on a house project and to decarbonize your home. You bought a home that was, it was built in the 1970s. You wrote that great paper I've shared with you folks about Kermit was right, it's not easy going green. Can you, I don't want to go too deep into it, but what were some of the takeaways from that experience?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. The paper is 27 pages long and growing because I keep unfortunately having to add to it every time I try to make an improvement. So, you know, we have the technology, but there's way too much happy talk in our field and in our community and overselling of how easy it is to do this. And there's just this recurring theme of low quality execution and lack of usability and lack of user-centered, you know, planning. And more particularly, you know, there was a LinkedIn post I saw last week, and this installer of heat pump water heaters, he's had to pull out 20 of the 21 heat pump water heaters he's installed because of noise complaints from the homeowners. You know, noise is an issue that's supposed to have been resolved years ago, and everybody's saying it's resolved and it's not. And at any rate, I think a deeper problem is much of the workforce really doesn't have the mentality. There are good tradespeople, And there are people doing this, obviously, but these are the exceptions. Mm-hmm. And most of the workforce, what I've found on not just my own home, but others, is, you know, there's a real competency gap and there's a real soft skills gap. Following through, communicating clearly, thinking things through, you know, documenting. It's a problem. I put triple pane windows in the house, heat mirror windows that we had helped develop at LBL, the basic technology back in the 80s. And, you know, the patio doors are sticking. An older person would not be able to open these doors. And my children at the time could not open the doors if they were sealed well. And I just, some heat pump installer just recommended to me a dual fuel heat pump in a mild climate. So he wanted to put in a natural gas furnace, you know, backing up a heat pump in, you know, mild Northern California. And the list is just unfortunately very long. So I see the problem. There's a lot of very also libertarian minded people in the trades who really poo-poo the government and the programs and the incentives. And they don't get smart on the incentives. They disrespect the guidelines. You know, I'm putting in a system right now at a second home and they've refused to size it. And I ran the calcs and the unit they're recommending is twice this heat pump, twice the necessary size, you know, and just on and on. So it's demoralizing. And I think we have deeper problems than we want to recognize in the policy community and in the rah-rah. I mean, I'm as rah-rah as the best of them on we can do this and look at all these great examples, but scaling this up and not turning people off, we call it market spoiling. You know, I wrote a whole piece recently on heat pump water heaters, the history of heat pump water heaters in the US and then comparing to other countries. And the federal government and the state entities and the utilities have done so much to spoil the market for heat pump water heaters by getting out over their skis and, you know, not listening to their own research and not following their own survey results and getting technology out there that's not ready for prime time. Now we have great heat pump water heaters, but still, you know, they first came to the US in 1950s and they've been in and out of the market here and just ruining, you know, failing and the companies leaving and pulling out and the consumers are on this roller coaster ride that's really a turnoff, you know, and so people, there's a lot of hesitancy now about them.
So I want to
talk about the errors, you know, that are happening. Sorry.
I don't want to leave the conversation on a down note. So I take it that your passion then is raising awareness. It's not just a technological, but it's the whole infrastructure, the installation. It's the mindset of the trades. It's a myriad of issues that have brought us to this point. And your job is to raise awareness about that so that we do start developing the trades better and we do work on our supply chains, et cetera. Is that right?
Yeah, and the delivery mechanisms too, the program design. And really, I got to work a lot with specialists in the field called usability on software development. And that's like a software thing. Do people understand this tool? Can they navigate through it? Do they do what you want them to do? They have the experience you want them to have. And I think we need to see, and we can see more of that mentality brought to efficiency and decarb program design. You know, does your website make sense? Does it work? Do people, are there dead links? And, you know, do they get the wrong advice? Or they were forced to wait too long? There's all kinds of things. So yeah, I think there's room to improve. There's always room to improve. And a great example of that is building commissioning, which is an area I worked in a lot. And we built a database of 600 million square feet of commercial buildings in the United States that have been commissioned, which is quality assurance. It's not technology. It's coming in and seeing that things are working the way they were supposed to and things haven't been defeated. And we got median 15% whole building energy savings for 10 cents a square foot, you know, on the first study, you know, payback time in weeks and months and avoiding quality problems. So we know how to quality assure, but it's just not done enough. So quality assurance, quality control is just as important as having a good idea and good gear and good best practices guides, you know, is it making sure that it happens and that the tradespeople are more respected, you know, and more better educated and trained. And I am optimistic guardedly about being able to do that.
Let's stop right there. How great. I've really enjoyed this conversation and catching up with you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Evan.
My pleasure. It's rare that we get to kind of have a structured opportunity to reflect, you know, and take stock. And so I thank you for the opportunity to think and talk about it.
You're more than welcome. And thank you for all that you've done contributing to this world of energy efficiency and preserving the planet.
Pleasure.
Talk to you soon. That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.